animal. Talks like an animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animal. Talking animal. Talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. And before we go any further, let me thank all those who donated in support of Talking Animals as part of WMNF's Fall Fund Drive. We reached and exceeded the show's fundraising goal, for which I'm enormously grateful. Thank you very much for all your pledges before and during last Wednesday's Fund Drive show. And in additional good news, a few days later, WMNF made the overall station goal. So a big thank you to all who pledged in support of WMNF. We really, really appreciate it. As for today's show, my guest is Captain Paul Watson, the founder, president, and executive director of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, a marine conservation organization whose profile rose dramatically in the wake of Whale Wars, the Animal Planet series that aired for several years, documenting Sea Shepherd's efforts to thwart Japanese whaling expeditions, with Watson typically leading those efforts. In an interview recorded last week, Captain Watson, who will speak at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest November 3rd at Perry Harvey Senior Park in Tampa, discusses his recent period of exile and the international legal troubles that led to it, the transformation of Sea Shepherd, some of the numerous campaigns the organization is currently undertaking, last week's climate report, the state of the seas and the fish population, and more. I'll play back that interview in just a few minutes here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll speak with Loretta Williams, event coordinator of St. Francis Society Animal Rescue's KittyCon Tampa Bay, which they're billing as, among other things, a fan convention for people crazy about cats. It's slated to happen Saturday, October 27th at the Holiday Inn West Shore in Tampa. Finally, a programming note. Next week's edition of Talking Animals will be a special show devoted to greyhounds and Amendment 13, the ballot provision that, if it passes on November 6th, would end greyhound racing in Florida by 2021. My guest in the studio will be Carrie Thiel, executive director of Grey2K USA Worldwide, a national greyhound protection organization, and Don Goldstein, Talking Animals' longtime greyhound correspondent. With any luck, we may also be joined in studio by one or two retired racing greyhounds. Of course, as usual, we'll also incorporate phone calls, emails, and texts, and all of this will stream on Facebook Live. That's Wednesday, October 24th at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals here on WMNF. Right now, let's hear my interview with Captain Watson, recorded last Tuesday. This is Captain Paul Watson back on Talking Animals on WMNF. So thanks for joining us again, Captain Watson.
Thank you.
So over the years, I've been fortunate enough to speak with you on this show multiple times, but it certainly has been a while, and I doubt I'm the only one that's had trouble tracking the various circumstances of the last few years, charges that kept you away from certain countries while seeking refuge in other countries, and stepping away, at least temporarily, of course, from your roles at Sea Shepherd. So can you walk me through what exactly happened in those last few years and the status of things at the moment?
Well, with myself personally, and with Sea Shepherd, yes. In 2012, I was on my way to the Cannes Film Festival when I was stopped in Germany and arrested on an extradition request by Costa Rica, which was a surprise to me because I hadn't been in Costa Rica since 2002. But way back in 2002, I intercepted a shark finning operation in Guatemala and was requested by the Guatemalan government to stop it, which I did, and didn't hurt anybody, didn't damage any property. But when I got to Costa Rica, I was charged with 8 counts of attempted murder because the fishermen said that I tried to kill them. But we went into the court, and we had all the film because we were making the documentary Sharkwater with Rob Stewart. So we went into the court, they saw the film and our witnesses and dismissed the charges. And a week later, I was charged again, this time with 8 counts of assault. And once again, we went into court and showed the film, and they dismissed the charges, and I was given clearance to leave Costa Rica. I never heard another word about it until 2012, when suddenly I'm arrested. Now the charge is something called shipwreck endangerment, which nobody really knows what it was. So I was arrested and held under house arrest, and while I was being held under house arrest, Japan applied for extradition to Germany, and at the end of July, I was informed by somebody in the Ministry of Justice in Germany that I would be sent to Japan, not Costa Rica, and so I left Germany, and I didn't have any papers, but I managed to leave on a boat out of the Netherlands and get my way to American Samoa and do the campaign down the Southern Ocean, and then spent like 15 months in total in exile at sea until I was given leave to return to the U.S. by Secretary of State John Kerry, because he realized all this was pretty bogus. The end result of all of this is that 2 months ago, Costa Rica dismissed the red notice against me, and although Japan still continues. But it's all very politically motivated, and it's being investigated by a European Committee on Human Rights and by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights for abusing Interpol for political purposes.
So, Captain Watson, the way that you sort of ran this down, was Japan's behind the whole Costa Rica charges from the get-go?
The Costa Rican warrant was issued 1 week after the president of Costa Rica met with the Prime Minister of Japan in 2011. I'm pretty sure that Japan was behind it, although, of course, nobody's going to admit to that. The fact that the new government that was elected into Costa Rica had this dismissed is an indication of the political nature of the whole thing.
Wow, because, yeah, it sounds like you hadn't been to Costa Rica in many, many years, and then suddenly there's these charges, and then not long after that, there's this Japan extradition. So not too hard to connect the dots. You don't have to be a big cynic, really, to see how that's going, I guess. But
But now we have a more progressive government in Costa Rica, and they dismissed the charges.
Okay, so you're all free and clear, and you can travel. At this point, can you travel pretty much wherever you would like, or are there certain places that you still need to steer clear of?
Well, I can't travel at all, because although the red notice was dismissed against me by Costa Rica, I still have the red notice against me from Japan.
Okay.
And what that's based on is that in 2011, the Japanese deliberately destroyed a vessel that was working with us, the Adi Gil, and the captain of that vessel boarded a Japanese whaling boat to demand, to confront the captain and just destroy his $2 million boat. And he was promptly arrested and charged with trespassing. He was then taken to Japan, and he made a deal with the prosecutor. They said that if you say that Paul Watson ordered you to board the Shonamaru number 2, we'll give you a suspended sentence, even though I'm on tape on the show Whale War advising them not to do it.
Right.
But anyway, he did do that, and that was when the Japanese laid a charge of conspiracy to trespass against me. And I'm actually the only person in history to be put on the Interpol red list, which is for war criminals, serial killers, and major drug traffickers.
Wow.
I'm the only person in history to be put on that for conspiracy to trespass.
Well, a badge of honor of sorts, I guess. Yeah. There's always some sort of very thick, crazy intrigue, it seems like, when it comes to especially any kind of confrontations with the Japanese whalers. Now, I guess during that exile, you were sort of prompted to relinquish some of your duties or at least titles at Sea Shepherd. Now that you're largely back, what role do you now hold beyond, obviously, founder? But, I mean, what roles are you currently holding?
Well, I'm on the board of all the Sea Shepherd entities, president of the Sea Shepherd USA. But Sea Shepherd is not an organization. It's a movement, and it's doing quite well. In fact, I think in many ways, because of all of this, we diversified, and there's now like 40 different Sea Shepherd entities, and that's made us far more efficient. So we're now a movement where we want an organization.
Interesting. So give me an example of some of the things in the wake of diversifying, things that you are now doing or able to do that when you were more traditionally an organization you were unable to do.
Well, we've divided into Sea Shepherd Global, which operates some of the vessels, Sea Shepherd USA, which operates others. We're now patrolling the east and the west coast of Africa, very effectively intercepting poachers. We're in partnership with the governments of Gabon, Liberia, Cape Verde, Sao Tome, and Tanzania. We're also in partnership with Mexico to protect the endangered vaquita in the Sea of Cortez. And we've also formed partnerships with Ecuador to protect the Galapagos National Park and Peru to intervene against illegal fishing in their waters. So the new approach that we've developed is these partnerships where we have resources, we have volunteers, but we don't have the power of enforcement. So these partnerships give us that power of enforcement. enforcement to intervene against illegal activities and to shut them down.
That's like a seismic shift then in terms of, for many, many years, what you would do to call attention to things and try to thwart efforts, but you didn't have the capability for enforcement. So that seems like a gigantic change.
Yeah, it's a very significant change. And I don't think any other non-government organization's ever done this, where forming a partnership with actual authorities from existing government.
And I think you touched on some of these, but I mean, does that mean that you also have a broader array of campaigns at any given moment than you might have before diversifying?
Well, yes, we have so many campaigns right now, I can't even keep track of
them. I know, I was trying to prepare to speak with you, and I thought, oh my God, this is quite an endless list. But you touched on one that I thought was interesting, just, I mean, among many, but the vaquita. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think there's a lot of people who may not know as much about that animal and its status, how critically endangered its status is.
The vaquita is the most endangered cetacean on the planet right now. There's between 12 and 30 of them left. And we're now in our fifth year of what we call Operation Milagro, or Miracle. And what we do is we simply go in, locate, and confiscate the nets which are killing the vaquita in the vaquita refuge. And so far we've confiscated about 110,000 meters, about 800 nets altogether. And I think that this is the key to really protecting the vaquita. We pulled $1 million worth of nets out of the vaquita refuge at a heavy cost to the poachers. And at the same time, if we get them out as quickly as they put them in, that prevents the vaquita from becoming entrapped in them. And it's a dangerous campaign. We've had three of our drones shot down. We've been shot at. We do have Mexican sailors on board who are armed. But, you know, it's a, and we're, our drones have been very effective in capturing them because we, using FLIR cameras, we can see them at night as soon as they drop the net. So I can safely say we're not very popular among some of the fishing villages in Mexico right now.
So for people who may not know what the appeal is, why are vaquitas poached to that degree?
Well, they're not going after the vaquita. They're going after a fish called the totoaba, which is about the same size as the vaquita. The vaquita are a bycatch. And the reason they're going after the totoaba, which is also an endangered species, is that the swim bladders on the totoaba are worth about $20,000 a kilo in China. For some sort of bizarre snake oil medical remedy, which, you know, has no scientific validation behind it at all. That superstition is what's driving the extermination of both the totoaba and the vaquita.
So they are just going after the fish. The vaquita are a bycatch, but meanwhile, their numbers have dwindled to, I think you said, between 12 and 30. Anywhere in the world, that's all the population that's left?
The vaquita only exists in the upper part of the Sea of Cortez,
yeah.
What is now called the vaquita refuge, and their numbers have gone down from, you know, 900 20 years ago down to 300-400 now, what it is between 12 and 30. And the Mexican government's putting a lot of money and resources into addressing this, but you know, the greed of the totoaba smugglers is pretty powerful. And although many of them are being intercepted and there's been numerous arrests, you know, the flow continues. But I think that over the last year we've managed to, you know, to keep these numbers down significantly on the number of totoaba are taken. And I'm hopeful that this new season, which is already underway and goes until next June, will be our most effective campaign season ever.
So, Captain Watson, obviously the key focus of Operation Milagro is to protect the vaquita from being caught in that as bycatch. But is there any effort either on that, on the part of Operation Milagro or the government's part, to do whatever they can to try to restore some of that population, or that 12 to 30 that are still around? Are they breeding? Are they able to breed?
Well, they're very slow breeding animals. There was an effort last year by the government supporting these scientists, a lot of them from SeaWorld and everything, to capture the vaquita and keep them in captivity where they could be bred. I actually warned the Mexican government that this was not going to work, and in fact, that's what happened. The two vaquita that they captured died of stress pretty quickly, so that whole thing was shut down. And finally, because of that, they began to listen to what we were doing as the most effective way of protecting the vaquita, which is to get those nets out of the water.
So that protects more of them from being captured, but I guess it's still a tricky and unresolved question. It sounds like how to increase their population again.
I think the best way to increase their population is to just leave them alone.
Okay.
Let them recover.
So if they are protected and left alone, your thought is they will be able to breed and come back at least to some extent with those numbers.
I've never ever supported captivity as a solution to this. If you remove a species from its environment, you pretty much have rendered it extinct. I mean, you cannot separate the two.
Yeah, no, it just sounded like it's such those numbers are so low that it just seems so dire. I didn't know what sort of remedies might be in place. And geez, as you say, there's so many other campaigns. I mean, are there one or two others that you might want to highlight? I mean, there's such a slew that we could spend the whole time just talking about campaigns, but I have other things I hope to discuss with you as well.
Well, we have a crew in Nicaragua protecting turtles, another crew in the island of Mayotte between Madagascar and Mozambique, also protecting turtles from poachers. We recently returned from a campaign to focus attention on protecting the Great Barrier Reef. And also in Australia, we were able to stop BP and Shell Oil from drilling in the Great Australian Bight, although now we're battling a Norwegian company called Statoil that wants to do the same thing. We just finished Operation Virus Hunter up in British Columbia, where we're opposing domestic salmon farms, and the research we've been doing is showing and illustrating that domestic salmon farms are transmitting viruses and parasites to wild salmon populations. And so we're fighting in the courts against the Canadian government, the salmon industry, on that particular thing. Where we just recently intervened at the request of Peru against the Chinese squid fleets operating, you know, off the coast of, well off the coast of Peru. And that vessel right now is in and out of the Galapagos while we continue to monitor the Chinese squid fishing activities. There's so many campaigns, which is very difficult for me to go into them, but they're all being hugely successful and driven by the passion, the courage, and the imagination of our hundreds of volunteers around the world.
In fact, that made me wonder as you were rattling off some of those, that's still not all of them, as you say, but is the general number of Sea Shepherd volunteers largely the same as it's been, but just because of the partnerships that you forge, you're just able to do so many more campaigns and other efforts because of those partnerships?
Well, we have 15 ships and hundreds of volunteers. I'd say we have more volunteers now than ever.
Okay.
But it's really hard to keep track of everybody and what they're doing.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it's well kept track of by the individual entities, like the Sea Shepherd France, Sea Shepherd Germany, Sea Shepherd Brazil, Sea Shepherd Australia. But from a global perspective, it's difficult to keep track of it all.
For sure. But it sounds like at least I'm guessing some of that may have been through just a broader awareness. In fact, I imagine the awareness of Sea Shepherd overall spiked tremendously during the years of Whale Wars, the Animal Planet show that tracked Sea Shepherd's efforts to thwart Japanese whalers in the Southern Ocean. Looking back a bit, how do you feel about the whole Whale Wars experience? To what extent was it a boon, and to what extent did you personally and or Sea Shepherd sort of pay a little bit larger price than you might have liked for the Whale Wars involvement?
I don't think we paid any price at all. You know, the most powerful weapon in the world is the camera. And Whale Wars gave us the opportunity to bring the massacre of whales in the Southern Ocean you know, to literally tens of millions of people worldwide, and put a lot of pressure on Japan, and also gave us a lot of support. And in addition to Whale Wars, the TV show, we've also participated in numerous documentaries, whether like Cowspiracy, Sharkwater, and Leonardo DiCaprio has just completed a film on the Vaquita campaign. So those ongoing documentaries with the TV show have certainly helped.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said from a media point of view, if it isn't on camera, it might as well have never happened. So we tend to go to sea armed very heavily with cameras.
Well, no, that seems like that's whether it's for a specific TV project or film project, or like you say, just documenting work and have, especially if they're later is some sort of a dispute, as you noted with the whole Audie Gill thing, and then what you were on camera saying or not saying in Whale Wars that clarified the contention there about you had ordered this to happen. So, yeah, cameras are your friends for sure. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm speaking with Captain Paul Watson of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. He'll be speaking at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest November 3rd at Perry Harvey Senior Park. This conversation was recorded last Tuesday. Captain Watson, so I guess with all the charges and things cleared up, and you seem to be spending much more time again in the U.S. It seems like they hear and read about Sea Shepherd receptions. Of course, you'll be doing the Veg Fest appearance. There's something else coming up, I think, after that in Miami. So does spending more time here lately pose particular challenges given the current president and his, just how you might feel about his environmental policies?
Well, Sea Shepherd concentrates on illegal activities, which keeps us busy around the world, but we haven't had any cause to intervene with American issues. American enforcement, like wildlife enforcement and everything, is pretty good in relative to other countries.
Okay.
You know, the president says a lot of stupid things, but, you know, the enforcement agencies are still doing their job.
It's just, he's obviously rolled back so many environmental policies and seems to be intent on rolling back more that, yeah, even if it didn't have a direct connection to Sea Shepherd's work, I just thought you might have...
Well, I always look on these things, you know, politics is like a pendulum. It swings left, then it swings right, then it swings back left again, and that's the way it's going to happen. So this guy will be gone, and someone will have to deal with some other politician. When you really get right down to it, they're all pretty much the same, even though some are probably more ludicrously apparent than others. But
yeah.
If you take a look at almost every country in the world, you know, politicians are driven by greed and by, you know, vested interest. You know, look at Canada, where I'm originally from, is that we have a prime minister. Everybody thinks, oh, you're so lucky to have Prime Minister Trudeau, you know, rather than Donald Trump. But really, when it comes to issues like, say, like climate change, there's no difference between the two, except that Trudeau says, well, this is really a problem. We have to address it. And Trump says it doesn't exist. But the actions of both of them are exactly the same, and that is do nothing.
So that sort of brings me, as we were recording this interview just yesterday, in fact, the International Panel on Climate Change released that report brimming with dire findings. And one upshot of the report in broad terms is that if there isn't a huge global effort to make changes over the next decade, it'll be too late to save the planet. So are your thoughts, I was curious to get your thoughts on the report generally, but are your thoughts that Trudeau, Canada more broadly, is simply inactive and just not going to take any steps to help remedy this?
Well, they're actually taking steps in just the opposite direction. So, you know, in Canada, Trudeau's approving the pipelines and stands solidly behind the tar sands project. You know, they're not doing any. In fact, they're doing just the opposite. But, well, you know, it is a dire report, but nobody takes these reports seriously. Look at the time, you know, the 20 years leading up to World War II and the rise of Hitler. The warning signs are there. The warning signs, this is going to get out of, this is ridiculous, it's going to get out of control and everything. And nothing happened until the war broke out. And then that's the way things are with human beings. You know, they don't react until it's too late. And sometimes it's going to be really too late.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure you're probably right. I mean, one, and this is a super tiny and personal thing that I felt at least mildly encouraged by. But I have a 14-year-old who came home from school yesterday, and in science class, they talked about the report, and he was spooked. And he said, you know, what can we do? So, I mean, that's just one 14-year-old, but if it could be extrapolated at all, maybe people will start to take some action if that generation is actually starting to feel concerned by the report. So,
if his generation was running the planet, I'm sure we would address it. But his generation is not running the planet.
Yeah.
And as seen with the recent Kavanaugh, you know, charade, that it doesn't matter what people want. It doesn't matter what people are concerned with. The vested interests will get what they want. I've always said that the United States is an oligocratic oligarchy, which is government by the oil companies, for the oil companies, of the oil companies.
Yeah, too true, I'm afraid. But I don't know. I guess I'm just hoping that maybe this time that kind of report will shake some people up and actually spur some action, but maybe that's too Pollyannish of you. But I gotta cling to the hope.
We can only hope. But I mean, for recently, a friend of mine who is the environment minister of France, one of the most powerful positions in France under President Macron, he resigned last month. He says, you know, I can't accomplish anything within this government. You know, I know what the problems are. I'm trying to address these problems, but nobody wants to really listen to them. And I just refuse to continue to be here to greenwash this government.
Well, brave step and notable step, because that's how people get, I think, attention aimed at the charade that is probably going on that he just couldn't take anymore.
Yeah, I'll get to the point where, you know, we'll have to take action. But the question is, will it be too little, too late? At the climate change conference in 2015 in Paris, I spoke. I mean, nobody wanted to talk about the oceans, but, you know, the ocean regulates climate. And I said, well, you know, if we want to address climate change in any realistic sense, what we have to do is allow the ocean time to repair itself. And to do that, we need to immediately shut down all heavy gear industrialized fishing activities around the world. The 10 million fishing vessels that are out there on the sea right now just plundering everything, strip mining, clear cutting, basically all life in the ocean. If we allow the ocean to repair itself, we can address climate change. You know, for hundreds of years in Polynesia, the shamans would declare an area, say, this bay in Tahiti, this is a kapu, it's forbidden. Nobody is allowed to fish here for 20 years. And if anybody was caught fishing in that bay during that 20-year period, it was the death penalty. And people say, well, that's a little extreme. No, it's not. When you consider that the Polynesians understood that if the fish disappeared, they would die. They would disappear. So therefore, it's a matter of self-preservation. And as I always say, if the ocean dies, we all die. We don't live on this planet with a dead ocean. And by 2048, according to Dr. Boris Worm and Dr. Daniel Pauly, the two foremost fisheries biologists in the world, there won't be any fishing industry because there won't be any fish. And that's a realistic prediction based on solid scientific observation. And yet, it's not given any credence at all by the fishing industry. They just continue to take and take and take. I mean, look at the world we live in where, 40% of the fish that's caught from the ocean is fed to the livestock. So we now have a world where chickens are eating more fish than puffins and albatrosses, and domestic house cats are eating more fish than all of the seals in the North Atlantic Ocean. It's just absolutely out of touch with natural reality. But nobody, it's all out of sight and out of mind. Nobody really gives it any thought at all. We're literally eating the oceans alive. And like I said, if the ocean dies, we all die.
Okay, well, this again is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Captain Paul Watson, founder of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. He'll be speaking at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest November 3rd at Perry Harvey Senior Park. This conversation was recorded last Tuesday. Sort of bridging both what you just said, Captain Watson, and maybe as a bit of a sneak preview of your talk, I believe the talk you're slated to give at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest on November 3rd is entitled Why There Is No Sustainable Fishing and Helping Our Oceans. I think obviously you probably touched on some of that just a moment ago, but can you give us something of a sneak preview of that talk, especially maybe the Helping Our Oceans portion?
Well, I'd like to. The problem is I never ever know what I'm going to say at a talk until I actually up there talking. So
okay.
I can't really say exactly what I'm going to say.
Okay.
But it would be addressing, of course, what we're doing to the ocean, the diminishment of species, focusing on the fact that we have to live within the context of the three basic laws of ecology, which is diversity, interdependence, and carrying capacity, that finite resources, really. To just be blunt, there's no room on this planet for 8 billion fish-eating, meat-eating primates. And unless we change our behavior in that respect, then we're not going to survive. But, when people say, well, aren't you pessimistic about it? I say, no, I'm internally optimistic because I've studied, the effects of major extinction events in the history of this planet. And we're now in the sixth major extinction event called the Anthropocene, because we're responsible for it. But in every case of those five major extinctions before us, what they all had in common was it took 18 to 20 million years to recover. So if we don't survive the Anthropocene, and a lot of other species don't either, 18 to 20 million years from now, it'll still be a nice, pretty nice planet. So it's not about saving the planet. It's about saving ourselves from ourselves.
Well, and so again, I guess like everything that we've sort of touched on, just more broadly, climate change, and this specifically, people will know that there's problems, they won't do anything about the problems, and the beat goes on, I guess.
It does, and we have to also understand that reality is more than just us, that all these other species. I guess the best way to look at it is look on the planet as a spaceship, which is what it is. We're on this incredible voyage around the galaxy, and we're traveling at an incredible speed. But every spaceship has a life support system, and that life support system provides food and the oxygen, the air we breathe, and regulates climate and temperature. And the life support system for spaceship Earth is the ocean, and it's run by a crew. And we're not crew members. We're just passengers having a wonderful time entertaining ourselves. But what we are doing are killing off the crew. The worms, the trees, the fish, the phytoplankton, we're killing them off. and you can only kill off so many crew members before the machinery begins to break down and the life support system is no longer capable of supporting life. And so really what we need to do is protect the crew that keeps Spaceship Earth running.
Wow, that is quite a metaphor there. That's a lot to take in, but I like it. So Captain Watson, I was speaking with my mother-in-law yesterday, a Canadian, who of course super familiar with you, and just said, God, I haven't heard from him in some time. So part of the reason I wanted to get in earlier in our conversation about hearing more specifically about those years where you were facing those kind of charges, trumped up as they were. So among the things that related to that, I'd be interested to know is for that time that you were in exile, I mean, I still saw and heard things that you would say or do, but I mean, you were obviously hamstrung in many ways. What was that period like where you, in fact, you couldn't really do what Paul Watson does?
Well, I don't think that was ever the case because with Sea Shepherd, you know, over the years, I've delegated to so many people to carry on this. I mean, Sea Shepherd could run quite well without me. So I've never really been concerned about that. We've got some incredible captains and officers and directors and all around the world. So that's one of the things I most feel satisfied with is the fact that this is now a movement and it can operate quite efficiently without my being involved in it.
Right. But that said, I mean, still, you have been a focus for many years and an incredibly eloquent and passionate spokesman for many years and affecting change in those roles for many years. So to me, I just thought, maybe I'm wrong, but I just thought for some of those years where you were kind of neutralized necessarily just because of all the kind of crazy international legal troubles, just personally more than how it's felt for Sea Shepherd. I just wondered just if that just a difficult thing to contend with for that period of time.
No, during the time that I was like in exile, I was down there fighting the Japanese whalers off the coast of Antarctica.
Yeah.
Spending time cleaning up plastic debris on South Pacific islands like the Tonga, Vanuatu, and New Caledonia, and the Great Barrier Reef. So I was actually active, but at the same time in touch with Sea Shepherd through the internet, even though I'm out on the boat, you know, we have satellite uplinks and that.
Yeah.
So nothing really changed except for my physical ability to travel.
I see. Okay. We're just sort of nearing the end of our time. And again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss and speaking with Captain Paul Watson, founder of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Again, he'll be speaking at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest coming up November 3rd at Perry Harvey Senior Park. This conversation was recorded last Tuesday. Captain Watson, you've had so many experiences, good, bad, horrific, heavenly, whatever, on the sea. I'm just wondering, like, how it feels now in 2018 to be on the sea compared with the earliest years. Is there any measurable difference? Is it pretty much, hey, this is how it's always been when I've been on the sea? I mean, I just feel like there's got to be some sort of arc there of some kind for you.
Well, I was raised in a fishing village in eastern Canada back in about the 50s and the 60s, and yes, there is a very apparent diminishment of life. What was once is no more. And the problem that we have as humans is we have this ability to adapt to diminishment. Is that is, we forget the way things were and accept the way things are. You know, for example, 1968, if I were to have told you that, you know, in 30, 40 years, you'll be buying water in plastic bottles and paying more for that water than the equivalent amount of gasoline, you would have looked at me like I was insane. But how we've quietly adapted to that diminishment. We've adapted to diminishment of lesser fish and lesser resources and, we simply adapt. And, you know, this is a virtue that certainly helped us back in hunting gathering days when we had to adapt to diminishment. But today, I think it could be our undoing.
I'm just wondering if just your own personal experience from starting off as a boy in that village, is it still a sense of exhilaration as soon as you're out on the water? Does it feel different just because it's been so many years? I just feel like there must be something over the course of those years that might have shifted in some way, or maybe you do feel exactly the same, and it almost transports you back to how you did feel in those first years as a boy getting on the water.
Well, I'm always happy to be out on the water, but you know, when I look back to those years, I mean, we walked the beaches in 1957 without seeing one piece of plastic on the beach.
Yeah,
I remember the incredible amounts of seabirds that used to be around, which are, you know, nowadays you see one or two seagulls. I'm right in the bay in San Diego, and I've seen one seagull this morning. You know, when I was a child, there would have been hundreds. You know, I used to see pods of dolphins, you know, 10,000 of them at a time. Now that's almost unheard of. So you know, there has certainly been a very visible and apparent diminishment in our ocean.
So it sounds like for you, the experience is really one of what has changed in the way that it's diminished rather than any other thing that leaps out at you over all those years on the water?
No, I do love the ocean. I mean, I love being in storms to just see the full power of the sea. But I never went to sea for profit. I joined the Merchant Marine of Norway and Sweden back in the late 60s, and my motivation was adventure. And then when I was 18, I was the youngest founding member of the Greenpeace Foundation, because I always felt that there was this need to defend and protect. And so that hasn't left me. I'm still doing the same thing now that I did 50 years ago.
So lastly, Captain Watson, with the transition from Sea Shepherd, from organization to movement, are there any role or roles that in the coming years that you'd like to see Shepherd fill, or even, I know there's a slew of campaigns at the moment, as we've discussed, but anything that you aren't currently engaged in that you think, hey, that's next when this situation comes together or when this opportunity presents itself, here's what I'd really like to see us get into that we so far haven't or haven't been as into as I'd like?
No, I'll let Sea Shepherd evolve as Sea Shepherd is inclined to evolve.
Yeah.
You know, back in 1973, I was a medic for the American Indian Movement during the occupation of Wounded Knee in South Dakota. And I remember talking with Russell Means, who was the leader of the American Indian Movement at the time. And I said to him, I said, look, Russell, we're surrounded by, you know, a couple thousand federal troops here. The 82nd Airborne was there, the U.S. Marshals, the FBI. So they're all shooting at us, you know, about 20,000 rounds a night coming into the village. And, you know, we're huddling down here in holes, waiting to be shot and everything. And I said, you know, we don't have a hope in hell of winning here. What are we doing here? And Russell said something to me that I've never forgotten. And he said, we're not here because we're concerned about the odds against us. We're not here because we're concerned about winning or losing. We're here because this is the right place to be, the right time to be here, and the right thing to do. And we'll let the future take care of itself. But all we can be responsible for is our actions in the present. And so that's been something that stayed with me over the years.
All right. Well, that might be the perfect place at which to leave it. Russell Means' words, as spoken by Captain Paul Watson. Captain Watson, thank you so much for joining us again on Talking Animals. And we'll look forward to seeing you on Tampa at VegFest on November 3rd.
All right. Thank you.
Again, my thanks to Paul Watson and the folks at Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. And as we mentioned a few times there, Captain Watson will be speaking at VegFest this year. And again, that's Saturday, November 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. The whole festival runs from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. This year, if you've been in the past, it's at a new location. It's at Perry Harvey Senior Park in Tampa. And there will be a number of the things that you have probably grown to like in past years. Guest speakers like Captain Watson and a handful of others, and all kinds of exhibitors and cooking demos and animal rescues and food samples, kids' activities. This year also, there is at least one new wrinkle beyond the location itself, of course, which is the vegan mac and cheese cook-off. That'll be happening, and they've somehow roped me into being one of the judges, so I'm not saying bribes could be accepted, but let's see what the offers look like before we make a definitive decision on that. Anyway, there's all kinds of great things, again, in store. And you can go to TampaBayVegFest.org. WMNF will have a table there, so I'll be wandering around and love to meet you. It's just a day's full of activities, but if you have a full day yourself, the 7 hours on tap, you can certainly scoot by before or after your kids' games or other obligations that day or whatever's going on. So hopefully we'll get a chance to say hello again. Saturday, November 3rd at VegFest at Perry Harvey Senior Park. Later on in the show, I'll speak with Loretta Williams about the forthcoming KittyCon Tampa Bay, happening Saturday, October 27th at the Holiday Inn West Shore. Right now, though, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner. We're going to hear something that feels extra relevant, I guess, at the moment for a number of reasons. This is David Huntsberger with a piece called The God of Ants in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
It just sucks that anytime science is making some strides, religion always interjects and stops them. Stem cell or anything like that. Like, science will try to actually help disabled children. Hey, maybe we can get in there and tweak with the genes. Nope, we'll just keep praying. Sweet, that's worked never, so yeah, keep going with that. And science will actually try to make a difference, and religion will come in and be like, you're playing God. Stem cells, you're playing God. Which I find is so odd that the same people who criticize you for playing God are the same ones that ask, what would Jesus do? It seems a little hypocritical. And who's to say who's ever played God? I have. You ever done it? I've played God. I went out and I found a little colony of ants, decided to make them my people. And so I built them a little habitat, a little world they could live in. Only took me one day, I'm just saying. And I built them this little world, and I just started watching them. They took right to it. They loved it. They were disco dancing and jet skiing and having all kinds of fun. And I thought, they probably want to know what this is all about. So one day I leaned in, and I was like, hey, guys, it's not about anything. Just enjoy yourselves. Have a good time. Peace. But I don't think they understood me, because they just started waging war on each other immediately and dividing into different tribes. They were sacrificing virgin ants and stink bugs. It was pandemonium. And all the while that was going on, I looked down. This one little ant was crawling up my leg. I was like, oh, he's going to come try to look God in the eye or bite me. I can't have that. So I started blowing on him. I'm like, get off me, dude. Get off me. And then I realized an ant can never look you in the eye. An ant can only just sort of perceive that you're here. If you put your finger down in an ant's way, he doesn't see your finger. He just sees another hill on his way to work. And then I realized, yeah, I am a hill to this ant. I'm Mount Everest to this ant. And then I could picture his little climbing journal like, base camp, day 2. Elevation, 4 feet. The wind is blowing incessantly. I lost my Sherpa a little over an hour ago. I doubt I'll ever see him again. I'll ride his mother when I get home. If I get home. And he did not get home. The wind was too strong for him and he died. And but while all that was going on, I didn't realize I'd accidentally stepped in their little ocean I made for them. And a huge wave washed on the sea and swept a bunch of them out to their deaths. I was like, oh, sorry guys, it's me, idiot God. I'm bad at this. My fault, sorry. But they had spent so much time fighting about me, they'd completely forgotten who I was. So all the little scientist ants were running around like, it was tectonic plates off the coast, it was a shift, it was an earthquake. I was like, what tectonic? You ungrateful little shits, enjoy this. Have some aftershocks, you miserable little assholes. Never forget. And Clay was not a good God. Like how similar we are to those ants. We're like, that last tsunami that happened in 2004, if that had happened 2,500 years ago, everyone would have been running around convinced that it was the gods. Poseidon, the god of the sea, we've angered the god of the sea. Anyone saying tectonic plates would have been beheaded. But in 2004, anyone running around saying Poseidon would have been locked in a straitjacket. Who's to know who's right? Maybe neither are right. Maybe we just got a little too close to someone's potato salad. No? Okay. I like that idea of perception, you know, that we don't know what's going on. Who knows what the clouds are? We think we know, we don't. Maybe there are other beings trying to communicate with us. We're like, whoa, it looks like a bunny. And the cloud's like, we're trying to be a buffalo.
Let's strike these little with lightning.
No one knows.
That was David Huntsberger with a piece called The God of Ants, taken from his album Humanitis. Now it's time to speak with Loretta Williams of St. Francis Society Animal Rescue about KittyCon Tampa Bay. Indeed, this is Loretta Williams back on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Loretta.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Thank you very much.
So let's start right in with the basics. What exactly is KittyCon?
Well, as primarily a cat rescue, St. Francis Society, we've always had problems finding events for just cats. And so we decided to go ahead and do one on our own. And it's a cat fan convention for people who love cats. And we, rented the hotel space, so the convention space at the Holiday Inn West Shore. We're going to have an adoption room sponsored by Maddie's Fund. And our goal is to get 50 cats adopted.
Wow, that's ambitious.
Yes, yes. And we've got a bunch of special guests coming. Chris Poole of Colon Marmalade and Laura Lassiter, the animal communicator. We've got Cameron Moore, the program manager of the Million Cat Project. And Adam Myatt, the Catman from West Oakland, and Sterling Davis, the Trap King.
Wow. Now, I'm starting to detect a theme. These all seem feline-related somehow. Nobody can get anything by me.
Right, exactly. It's all cats. The dogs stay home this time.
Yeah. Now, here's one thing right off the bat. If someone were inclined to and had the proper leash or harness, could someone that's attending bring their cat?
Unfortunately, no. This is a cat fan convention for people.
Yeah.
The only cats we'll have will be the ones that are available for adoption in the adoption room.
Sure. Well, again, let's hope that you hit that goal of adopting out 50. That'd be terrific, of course. So okay, so you've rattled up some of the folks that'll be there. What are some of the other activities over the course of the day that people might expect to enjoy?
Well, besides the meet and greets, we've got a meowing costume contest. We have Denny Mitchell is going to do his variety program all about cats.
Okay, well, wait, let's not go past some of these. Meowing contest, I think that requires at least a few words of description.
It's a costume contest.
Yes, of course. But are people supposed to come in Halloween-related cat costumes, or how does this actually work? I'm just trying to get the hang of the whole cat focus.
Sure, and anybody that wants to come in costume can come in costume. It's nice if it's a cat costume, but it doesn't have to be. And then at the end of towards the end of the day, we're going to all line up and do a little, costume parade, and we'll have we'll split people up into classes and judge them. See who has the best costume. The best in show.
That's cool. Now, what kind of prize awaits those who really throw themselves into their cat costume?
Well, we haven't really announced that yet.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I thought we might break some news here, but apparently not. Okay. So sit tight. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I didn't want to rattle off all the things without hearing about some of the details of some of these, just because, again, if I'm not mistaken, this is the first KittyCon, right, in Tampa Bay?
Yes, this is the first one. And all proceeds benefit St. Francis Society Animal Rescue. So it is a charity fundraiser. And, we'll have silent auction baskets and a live auction, things like that.
Now, is there also, apart from the costume contest, do we expect that there will be people in cat costumes that aren't necessarily even concerned with the costume contest?
Yeah, we have several cosplayers coming, and they'll be dressed up and walking around. And then also we have DJ Kitty's going to show up.
All right, tell us about DJ Kitty.
Yeah, DJ Kitty's agreed to come, and we're expecting DJ Kitty probably around maybe 4:30, 5 o'clock.
Okay.
And, you can get selfies taken with DJ Kitty, and it'll be a lot of fun.
And where would people, sorry, I'm revealing my own ignorance here, but where would people know DJ Kitty from?
Oh, he's the Rays mascot.
Ah, okay, cool. Classic gaffe of a guy who lives on the other side of the state. But, okay, so that's cool. Well, it sounds like it's going to be fun and great. And anything else that we should know about? Let's get exactly into the details, Loretta. So tell us exactly where, when, just for people that are hearing about this to say, hey, this might be something I might want to do on the 27th.
Okay. Attendees can get their tickets at KittyConTampaBay.org, and the event goes from 11 in the morning until 6 in the evening, but we have a special VIP ticket that will get attendees in for early entry for an exclusive early shopping experience with our Cat-tastic vendors.
Okay. We love Cat-tastic vendors. I mean, who doesn't? Yeah.
Right. So, and they'll be selling things, cat-themed products and supplies and things like that.
Yeah. So this strikes me, from what I've heard and what you've said here and what I've read otherwise, I mean, this seems like a pretty ambitious undertaking for the first event of its kind.
It really is. And, they're kind of, these cat fan conventions are springing up across the country. And Tampa Bay is really fortunate because we have some really important cat people. We've got Big Cat Rescue. They're a sponsor of ours, and they'll be doing a big panel on the status and legislation affecting the saving and the conservation of the lions and tigers.
Yeah.
And Waruva, the cat food company, is our title sponsor. And they'll be giving out lots of free samples.
All right. We can't talk about free even if it's... Yeah, we can't talk about prices even if they're free. I say a note this morning about that. But anyway, okay. So, this sounds like it's going to be chock full of fun. So for folks who want to find out more, again, might be driving, not be able to jot down details. You said the website is kittycontampabay.org?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And is there also a Facebook page where someone could just search in Facebook and come up with the same scoop?
Yeah, same thing. It's KittyCon Tampa Bay. Sponsored by Waruva.
Okay.
And then we're also on Eventbrite.
Okay.
I think it's on Eventbrite.
Great. All right. Well, this sounds like it's going to be quite the hoot. You know, that's not really a feline-related pun, but that's all I could think of at the time. So anyways, all right. Well, Loretta, thank you so much, and good luck. And we'll look forward to hearing how it all went. Unfortunately, I can't come over that day, as you know, but I'll look forward to a full report.
Okay, thank you. We'll see you next year.
All right, you bet. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Roy and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Meanwhile, on this show is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. I am Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune right now. In fact, this is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize again, as I say, a Talking Animals t-shirt to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. And I'll throw in a second prize if you can tell me why I played this particular animal song today. So this is it. Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. All right, if you can name that animal tune, we may take it still before we get off the air. Otherwise, we'll take it off the air at 813-239-9663. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lohr is up next with Radioactivity. Reminder that next week the show will be devoted to discussing greyhounds generally and Amendment 13 specifically. We're going to have in-studio guests Carrie Thiel and Don Goldstein, experts on that world. And with any luck, we'll also have a couple of retired racing greyhounds. So I invite you to join me for that show, which we also plan to stream on Facebook Live. So I also invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast, iTunes podcasts, or more. Actually, you know what? Let's see. Let's see what happened. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. You're live on WMNF. Can you name that animal tune?
Yes, sir, Duncan. Bullet with butterfly wings.
Wow, okay. And for your bonus point, why did I play that today in particular?
Oh, boy. My brain was racked trying to remember the tune.
Okay, no, I'm impressed that you did. But, okay, so it sounds like, well, you definitely won the prize as it is. Part two, no problem. The reason I did play it today is that was sort of the theme song and ran throughout Whale Wars, the show that Paul Watson, Captain Watson, and Sea Shepherd did on Animal Planet for several years. So, anyways, but okay, what is your first name?
My name's Jonathan.
Jonathan?
Yes, sir.
Okay, cool. I'm going to come back and take your information, but you have won the Name That Animal Tune for today. So thanks for listening. Congratulations.
Thanks, Duncan.
All right, thank you. So again, we'll have a special show devoted to Greyhounds, Amendment 13, next week on Talking Animals. And you can find out more about all our shows, including audio archives and iTunes podcasts of everything we've ever broadcast at TalkingAnimals.net. There's also links there to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally. Follow me on Twitter. And this is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. Community Conscious Radio, the last local radio. Thanks for listening. Speak with you again on Talking Animals.